Good morning and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, partner in charge of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more by visiting us on the web at www.businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our conversation today is with Steve App, Chief Financial Officer of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
And joining us in our conversation, also from IBM, is Dennis Kayser. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Paul.
Well, Steve, let's start by talking about the FDIC. Could you give us a historical background of the organization and its mission?
We're proud that FDIC has reached its 70th anniversary serving the American public. It goes back to the United States banking crisis in the early 1930s, and that culminated in a panic in March of 1933. At that time, President Roosevelt declared a banking holiday, closing all banks in the country. There was a quick legislative response, and the adoption of the Banking Act of 1933 is really what created the FDIC, and we opened for business January 1st, 1934, and at that time, the deposit coverage was $2,500. There's two important reasons for the adoption of deposit insurance. One was to provide protection for small savers. The other was really to add stability to the banking system. Before the introduction of deposit insurance, depositors in failed banks often lost some, if not all, of their money. The situation contributed to bank runs and severe liquidity problems in the banking area. For example, in 1933, at the height of the crisis, over 4,000 banks failed, and the very next year, only 9 banks failed. Finally, we added stability to the banking system because we added examination supervision of state-chartered banks that were not members of the Federal Reserve System. They had no federal supervision, and we became the primary regulator of those banks and added a lot of safety and soundness to that. All of these elements are with us today in our mission, and I'm proud to say also that since the FDIC's creation, no depositor has lost a single penny of their insured deposits.
How's the FDIC funded?
We are a federal government corporation, so we're independent of the appropriations process, and we also don't use taxpayer dollars to fund our operation. In essence, we're sort of like a car insurance company whereby we assess the bank's insurance premiums based on both their size and their riskiness. So if they have a larger deposit base and if they have riskier practices or driving record, if you will, they would pay more premiums. That said, over the years, we have built up the fund to about $46 billion, and by statute, we have a ratio that's very key to how we do business. That ratio is the fund balance, that $46 billion, over the amount of deposits, over $3 trillion. If that's above 1.25, we don't charge premiums for most of the banks. So because the fund's been very healthy for the last 7 years or so, over 90% of the banks have not paid assessments. So our funding stream over those last 7 years has been about 95% interest earned on the portfolio, over $2 billion a year, and only about 5%, about $100 million, comes from the actual assessments for a few banks who are in the very risky categories.
You describe the process of regulating financial institutions. I'm curious about the relationship between what the FDIC does and other organizations like the Office of Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve. How do they all fit together?
There are four of us who are the regulators for the bank and the thrift industry, and it's kind of divided into to different categories. There's about 9,000, a little over 9,000 financial institutions. We take care of the state non-member banks. The Federal Reserve does the state member banks. OCC national banks, the OTS does the thrifts. We work very carefully, however, and there's a council called the Federal Financial Institution Exam Council. Most of our principals on that. So a lot of policy changes and regulatory guidelines and things are issued jointly. We get comments back, and we sort of put those in place. So there's a lot of coordination amongst the four primary regulators. Also, two of those, the head of the OCC and the OTS, are actually board members on the FDIC to help make some of the decisions there. We also interact with the non-bank regulators like the Security and Exchange Commission, other people, not on as regular a basis, but for selected items. A lot of our banks are publicly traded, so some of the SEC rules would apply. So we do have interaction with some of the other non-banking regulators, but people that are engaged in the financial industry.
Steve, I'd like to shift gears a little bit. Can you tell me how many people actually work for the corporation and talk a little bit about some of the unique skill sets they have?
We are currently at about 5,300 people, and that's significantly down from the height of the S&L crisis when FDIC and the Resolution Trust Corporation together were about 23,000 people. So we've been downsizing for over a decade. In terms of the unique skills, like many of the regulators, we have some of the best talent in the industry, really. Very specialized. We have commissioned bank examiners that go through a rigorous 3 to 4 year process to get commissioned as bank examiners. Our legal team, our economic team, our financial analyst team, very specialized skill sets, very marketable skill sets to deal with the complexities of the industry. So we've tried to match our staffing to the changing industry.
Let's talk about your role a little bit. What are your responsibilities and duties as the Chief Financial Officer?
Well, I have the basic package under the CFO Act and then some additional things. We have all the financial reporting, monthly, quarterly, and annual budget financial statements. We're under commercial GAAP, and again, as I explained in the revenue picture, numbers really drive our organization. So unlike some of the government agencies, the financial statements are read by pretty much all the executives every month. We also do the planning, budgeting, and performance, and linking those together. In addition, we have sort of enterprise risk responsibilities for all the internal control, audit for our Inspector General and GAO in some cases. And then lastly, part of the basic packages in financial systems, sort of in charge of not only the core financials, but the peripheral financial systems. And I co-chair the Corporate Investment Review Committee, the Capital Investment Review Committee, with the CIO. So that also helps integrate the finance. But over and above that, I think the CFO community always hoped that once those things were shored up, we would have a seat at the table at more policy and strategic directives. So I actually also serve as one of the deputies to the chairman. We have a great corporate team, a good C team, if you will. The chief operating officer, the chief of staff, and myself sit on a number of governing committees, and that's really where a lot of the work is done. We have a national risk committee that we all participate in. We have a resolutions policy committee that we participate on. And then I chair various specific committees like the Investment Advisory Group, which is actually the group that makes the investments quarter by quarter in the portfolio where we get most of our revenues. So we really do have a seat at the table in the CFO's office, not just on the pure finance stuff, but really on some of the strategic direction of the corporation.
That sounds like quite a bit of responsibility. So how have any of your previous experiences prepared you for your responsibilities here?
Well, I have about 28 years of experience in the banking, finance, and insurance industry, and it gives me a lot of different reference points. Some of those were in the government, some in non-appropriated parts of the government, and some in the private sector. So I've been working the industry for quite a period of time, and I've been blessed with some very good bosses who have also kind of served as mentors to me. But I've been on different sides of the equation. I started out in the operations and payments area when I was at the Federal Reserve. I moved in sort of to the insurance realm during the height of the S&L crisis, working with Lloyd's of London and other insurance companies to both provide insurance to the banks and then also do direct consulting to the banks. And then I've been in agencies of the government who are very large, like HUD and Treasury, who do various things related to banking and finance, from mortgage banking to some of the central cash management for the government. And in general, it gives you a lot of reference points to draw on so that as you are faced with new problems and decisions, you don't just use one size fits all to resolve those problems. You draw on different things, you package it up correctly to provide the right solution that fits.
One of the unique things about both your career as well as the position you're in is the interaction between the public and private sector. You often hear, you know, the private sector does it this way, the government does it this way. I'm curious about your comparisons of, say, just management skills in the two sectors.
Well, first, I think it starts with the people. I think people in both cases are number one key, and there's a real war for talent to get the best people. What I found is that whether it's the private sector or the government, in the best-run organizations, because I think there's examples in government and private sector where you don't have the best-run corporations, but in the best-run corporations, the key is really the people, people that are competent and people that are passionate about what they do, and that makes management, of course, a lot easier. I think it divides a little bit at that point. In the private sector, the real galvanizing force is really the earnings pressure on the bottom line, and it's kind of a simple thing in a way that kind of gets the whole organization moving in the right direction. People are always chasing price points to get the best price, best quality. And so you begin to understand that whether it's a dollar earned in revenue or a dollar of cost savings, it's still a dollar to the bottom line. And that just pervades everything that they do. When you get into the government, I think you have to understand that many things aren't as purely driven as that, that a lot of things have multiple goals. If you look at some of the lending programs in the government, lender of last resort type programs, they're not just viewed as loans. They're job creation. There's other things associated with them. So I think in the government you find that perhaps we're not as cost conscious to the bottom line, because a dollar of savings doesn't quite mean the same thing. Also, I think you have to get used to that. There's a lot of other variables to deal with. It takes a lot of orchestration to get results, and that frustrates some people. But in a way, you're working on fairly significant things, so there's some built-in checks and balances in there to make sure that it's done right. In terms of management, the continuity of leadership in the government, I think, is a challenge for people, because on average, at the top levels, the political folks turn over about 18 to 24 months on average. And that's a little bit of a challenge compared to the private sector, where you have a Bill Gates or a Herb Kelleher who have been around for many, many, many years in that organization. So the vision is constant. The focus is constant. At FDIC, again, because we're a corporation, I think we have a little bit more focus on the private sector type philosophy, where we're very cost conscious. Our chairman has a 5-year term, so we get over some of those continuity of leadership issues. Board of directors, 6-year terms. And we do have a bottom line, and that affects the ratios and a lot of things. So we're a little bit more grounded that way, but we still have government responsibilities.
That's an interesting point about the continuity. How does the FDIC respond when a financial institution fails? We'll ask Steve App, CFO of the FDIC, to walk us through the steps when the Business of Government Hour continues.